This is the fourth day of this January 2018 Rohatsu 7-Day Sesshin. And a belated salute to those of you who are hearing this Teisho live streaming. It's great to know that our Zendo expands for hundreds of miles in all directions. We'll resume reading from the teachings of the Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim from the book The Way of Korean Zen. And a new chapter here called Discourses from a Winter Retreat. They would have these 90-day retreats in Korea, as they would sometimes in China. I don't remember that three-month retreat in Japan, hearing about that in Japan anywhere. The nature of the retreat, these 90-day retreats that I've heard about are different from our 7-day sesshins. I met a monk when I was on my travels, one of my pilgrimages. I met a monk who was just on his way out of one of those 90-day retreats at Kusan Sunim's place, and he said he had also been to a 7-day sesshin in Japan, and he said there's a lot of sleeping in the zendo over 3 months, and they don't have the use of the stick there. First lecture. I venture to ask the assembly, all of you, with a pure, undefiled, original nature, have you completely awakened to it or not? There he is, throws down the gauntlet. No. Hedging about really what the ultimate purpose of sesshin is, to awaken to our true nature. If by chance you have penetrated the profound meaning of the patriarchs, then say something. You may know the unchanging nature by seeing bamboos and pines in the snow. Do you understand? You may know the unchanging nature by seeing bamboos and pines in the snow. There's a koan in the Blue Cliff record called Taryu and the Indestructible Dharma Body, which a monk said to the master Taryu, the physical body ultimately decomposes. What is the indestructible Dharma body? Taryu said, the mountain flowers cover the hillside like brocade. The valley streams are blue as indigo. And then Kusan Sunim offers a verse, with the cessation of defilements, there is no high or low place. The pure original face cannot be assailed. In ice, flames appear. The bright light is all pervasive. The subtle Dharma, limitless as the sands along the Ganges, adorns the entire world. Although many rivers converge in the sea, in the end their taste is one, and the flow of their waters comes to an end. In the same way, defilements and false thinking endlessly flow from the conditioned mind. Due to this, we suffer beneath the wheel of birth and death. But when the mind from which defilements and false thinking flow is completely cut off, the high and the low disappear. Common and accomplished beings vanish. Originally, all is equal. Therefore, the pure original face cannot be assailed. And then he strikes his staff. The pure original nature that is able to hear this sound and see this staff cannot be assailed. It does not undergo the suffering of birth and death. It is not stained by defilements. Pointing, of course, to this unstained, immaculate, perfect, true nature that we all have in equal measure. This statement, when the mind from which defilements and false thinking flow is completely cut off, the high and the low disappear, common and accomplished beings vanish. Well, this mind from which defilements and false thinking flow is, of course, this discriminating mind, which divides, compares, judges, evaluates, this is the mind that is based on time and space, and by reaching a depth of concentration where this mind stops, even just temporarily, getting into a state of samadhi where this mind comes to rest is the experience of this absolute purity, the unconditioned, the realm of no space, no time, the eternal. This is time, as we've constructed it, still is a matter of this and that, discrimination. In our culture, we talk about eternity as something most people, of course, would think of as so remote and just inconceivable. Well, we can experience eternity every time we find a way to bring this discriminating mind to rest in complete absorption in the practice. There it is, eternity, no time, no before or after. It's right within our reach. He continues, all the affairs of the world are just like dreams. With a single stroke of a knife, completely sever all concerns. Only search for awakening. Not only must you discard all worldly fame, wealth, glory, comfort, learning, and cleverness, but the Buddhas as well. You must finish with it all. That is, must stop dwelling in thoughts of fame, wealth, glory, comfort, learning, cleverness, and Buddhas. An ancient master once said, "The bright light of the mind has never darkened. From ages past to the present, it has been the brilliant way. When entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge." And then Kusan comments, "This bright spiritual light, which is able to hear this sound and see this staff, has not darkened even once. Not once has it become a sentient being, that is, an unenlightened being. Not once has it become a Buddha or an enlightened being. Once you set up enlightenment, the enlightened and the unenlightened, once you set up either one, you have the other. You've divided what's in originally indivisible. For this reason, it is the way that is eternally radiant." Therefore, when entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge. After practicing for a while, you may come to think that you know something. Then you start conceptualizing. So, for example, if you have been meditating on mu, you may think, that which says mu, isn't that it? Those working on what is this may think, that which says what is this, is that not it? This approach is wrong. Therefore, avoid speculative thinking. You must possess truthfulness and sincerity in order to practice correctly. Truthfulness, sincerity. You can draw out this word sincerity to give it much greater significance than we usually think of it as having. To work on one's practice, whatever it is, truly, sincerely, is to be purely concentrated on it. It's not mixing it up with thoughts, but just be completely focused on the practice and the practice alone. He says, to practice simply because others are doing so is just imitation. You will never achieve anything in that way. I think of Yaza, late night sitting. To practice simply because others are doing so is just imitation. But you know, even if there's a little imitation there, if you're sitting, want to stay in a game and do your best the way others seem to be doing, that's not so bad. You sit down, if it gets you to sit down instead of trundling off to bed, if it gets you to sit down and go to work, then that can turn into something much more than imitation. In other words, you don't have to think, I'm going to wait until I'm 100% into sitting at night before I'm going to do it. Otherwise, to do otherwise is to be insincere. No, who's ever 100% into sitting at night? You must truly awaken in order to be freed from the suffering of birth and death. When you investigate the koan and intend to awaken to your great original nature, you must be like a hen hatching eggs. Think about how much effort the hen must exert in order to successfully hatch eggs. From dawn to dusk, she constantly pecks and searches for food. Imagine how hungry she gets while sitting on the eggs all day long. If she frequently leaves to eat or drink, only half of them will hatch properly. The rest will rot. While the hen is hatching her eggs, she does not just sit quietly. She moves the eggs around with her feet in order to evenly distribute the heat. Only in this way will the chicks hatch successfully. Remember, Kusan grew up on a farm, so he knows of what he speaks. And he says it's the same for somebody practicing meditation. Whatever your practice is, it will not mature if you just hold the koan motionless. If you just watch it repeating, what is this, what is this, what is this, then you would be like a hen trying to hatch her eggs without moving them. This would be foolish. You cannot awaken in this manner. You must be like the hen who moves her eggs around. So in other words, to engage with it, even if you're not fully questioning the koan, to not just stare at it and think something is going to change, but to find a way to actively engage with it. Yesterday we read him compare the earlier part of Sesshin to soaking the straw that is made into sandals. First there's the soaking stage, and then there is the active working with it stage. And that's where we are now. We're now just past the halfway point of Sesshin. This is when people who are working seriously have to engage with it. What does that mean? I can hear some people asking. Well, find a way to engage with it mentally. And then he switches the analogy. You must also be like a cat trying to catch a mouse. Observe the look of a cat that is trying to catch a mouse at the foot of a stone wall. While slinking along at the base of the wall, it keeps its eyes firmly fixed on the hole where the mouse entered. At a place far away from the hole, it then sits silently in hiding. Its eyes continue to stare piercingly at the hole while waiting for the mouse to come out. So this is engagement, even though the cat is sitting still, staring piercingly at the hole, it is truly engaged. There's no passivity there, even though it's immobile. It's intense concentration. At such a time, even if a person, a chicken, or a dog goes near the cat, it takes no notice of their passing and continues to watch the mouse hole. If the mouse appears for even an instant, like a flash of lightning, it leaps and grabs it. If even a cat proceeds so mindfully when trying to catch a mouse, how much more so should a person pursue awakening when practicing meditation? Furthermore, you must practice with a feeling of urgency, as though you were trying to extinguish a fire burning on your head. This is an analogy that you read in various Buddhist texts, to practice as though like someone with trying to put out a fire in your head. In such a situation, would you stop to ponder, is this heat due to fire, or is it really burning or not? Is there anybody present here who would experiment and let the fire burn for a while to see how well it burns? Under such circumstances, without thinking, you would immediately brush your hand over your head in order to get rid of the fire. You should cultivate meditation with the same sense of urgency. And he steps back and takes the big picture. To live long would be to live for 100 years. A short life is over in the time it takes to inhale and exhale a single breath. 100 years of life depends upon a single breath, for life stops when respiration ceases. Can you afford to wait for 100 years when you do not know how soon death will come? You may die after having eaten a good breakfast in the morning. You may die in the afternoon after a good lunch. Some die during sleep. You may die in the midst of going here and there. No one can determine the time of death. Therefore, you must awaken before you die. Look at the sea. Not only when there is wind do waves arise. Even when the sea is calm, waves are rising and falling thousands of times. He's pointing out here with this analogy, he's pointing out that even though our life may seem stable and on a nice track the way we want it to be, underneath, there is always the possibility of abrupt change. A defiled person will call this world a sea of suffering. An awakened one will call it a Buddha world. At that time, the 10,000 things will be transformed into the 10,000 subtle functions. For an enlightened person, it is simply all illuminated. For a defiled person, it is simply all defiled. All is arising from your own mind. This is the premise of meditation. The quality of our life, the way we see the world, life, the way we experience things, is determined by the mind. Our experience of the world is determined by the mind. The Buddha world arises from your own mind. Its transformation into the sea of suffering likewise arises from your own mind. Assembly, reflect on this. I trust that your practice will progress during this winter retreat. This back to this analogy about the waves. Even when the sea is calm, waves are rising and falling thousands of times. We can also understand these waves as the function of causation, cause and effect, that at any given moment, each one of us, every single moment, each one of us is cause and effect. And we can't know most of the causes. And so as a result, we can't know what effects are around the corner, what suffering may be soon to come. These waves, the action of these waves is the action of the natural flux of the world, the phenomena, this world. And we're all bobbing on this sea of causation. And the second lecture. Since we have entered this meditation retreat, 2 weeks have gone by. Now only 75 days remain. Truly, where is the subtle principle? And then he again takes up this vitally important matter of suffering. The sufferings of transmigrating within the ocean of birth and death, as well as the happiness of the sublime Dharma Dhatu appearing brilliantly before your eyes, do not come from outside. They are also not given to us by anyone else. You do not have to endure sufferings because someone else gave them to you. Neither does somebody else grant you happiness. They are created and experienced by yourself alone. You have to endure sufferings because you created them yourself. Likewise, you experience happiness because you have created it yourself. This is the fundamental perspective, that there is no someone else out there, that everything we experience is our own mind, the functioning of our own mind. If you really took this to heart, you would not be in any hurry to blame anyone for your misfortunes, your pain. You would turn that around and say, okay, what have I done that I find myself in this position now? You know, the law of karma, of course, can't be proven and never could be. It's not of the realm, of the empirical realm. But believing in cause and effect, does empower us, as opposed to leaving us in the position of victims. Okay, I put this all in place. I can find a way out. My happiness or misery does not rely on others. He continues, during the 24 hours of the day, in all of the four positions, that's standing, sitting, walking, and lying down, when you are coming, the koan should be coming. And when you are going, the koan should be going. You should investigate earnestly, carefully, and in detail. I always carefully observe meditators when they are walking here and there. How many hold the koan firmly? Usually when they are coming and going or eating, they completely forget about the koan and just act blindly according to circumstances. With such practice, it is hard to say when such people will ever awaken. You must pay a great deal of attention to this point. I love the sentence, you should investigate earnestly, carefully, and in detail. Even while sitting, or especially while sitting, we need to move in close to the practice, mentally close. I think of the word meticulously. It's just descriptions of intense attention. You should take great awakening as your aim and model, and never let the mind be at ease. If you act without caring to raise the koan, mind and body will surely be at ease. But this is just like water flowing away. Indeed, the lives of sentient beings flow away like this. So he's making the point that to work on a koan is to invite difficulty. It's to be willing to leave our comfort zone. Because if you're really grappling with a koan, it's not comfortable. It's really a state of unrest. Because the matter is yet to be resolved. So it can't be at rest. So there's a working. There's the willingness to do the hard work. And of course, that's how change happens, through effort. not through just gliding along in a relative comfort. A true koan practice is a practice of what we call doubt, which really means questioning. And that's not a comfortable, easy state. But it's a dynamic, really addressing directly one's dissatisfaction. He says, now, having taken up this practice, you should endure what is difficult to endure and do what is difficult to do. This is known as austerity, for the very reason that it involves undergoing what is difficult. The Buddhas and the patriarchs did not realize Buddhahood easily. They realized it through great effort and much hardship. They exerted themselves with such great effort because the sufferings of birth and death are so terrifying. There's a Chinese proverb, all discipline begins with a fear of death. You can make the case that's so, that in any kind of discipline we undertake, that underneath it, maybe way underneath it, but underneath it is this fear of not being, of dying. Or the fear of suffering more than we do while exerting ourselves in the discipline that we've chosen. Therefore, even though you want to sleep more, you should sleep less. Even though you want to eat more, you should eat less. Even though you want to talk a lot, you should try to talk less. Even though you want to see many things, you should see less. He's touching here on some of the discipline of a retreat. These 90-day retreats, they do talk, unlike our sashins, and I heard that they're not as strict about keeping the eyes down. So in just when you have just 7 days, which is what a lot for most lay people to carve out of their year, when you have just 7 days, you need to tighten things up and emphasize these other things of keeping the eyes down and maintaining silence. Your body will definitely feel restrained by acting in such a way. This is indeed a practice of austerity. However, none of the Buddhas and patriarchs would have awakened had they not trained themselves in this manner. Being bound by circumstances originates from the mind's own bondage. Likewise, liberation from the suffering of birth and death ensues from the mind's being liberated from them. This is the Dharma of one mind. Everything there is proceeds from this one mind. Access to the doors of both liberation and bondage lies in your own hands. Again, the empowerment that comes from taking responsibility for everything, oneself. It is not dependent upon anyone else. It is not dependent upon the Buddhas, nor the patriarchs, nor the spiritual advisors. Or, we could say, not dependent on God, God's grace. It is solely in your own hands. And he offers a verse, all the mountains, all the rivers, such a beautiful landscape. During endless eons, in each life, this world has appeared. No amount of praise could be enough. It is not the product of anyone's strength. Every single aspect of it arises from your own mind. He continues, last autumn, the maple trees were a brilliant red, the chrysanthemums fragrant, the mountains and rivers a magnificent sight. When we see all these beautiful things, we all know how to be happy. During endless eons in every life, we have been praising such things. It is not only this one time that we have praised them. When the moon is bright and the wind blows, some say that the moon is shining brightly and a refreshing wind is blowing. However, others say that the moon looks bleak and the wind is dreary. In reality, do you think that the moon is shining brightly to some and bleakly to others? This is not the case. These are circumstantial impressions arising from their own minds. That line from Affirming Faith in Mind, things are things because of mind. Just that is such a profound confirmation of the need to meditate. We create our own world by how we use or misuse the mind. We find this out in Sesshin every hour, that we can create miserable states. The Sesshin can become miserable, painful, or it can be the opposite, sublime. Sesshin can become sublime when we learn how to concentrate, and we can refrain from trafficking in our thoughts. That's all it takes. We can change our whole experience of Sesshin. Third lecture. Since the subtle wisdom of complete enlightenment has been present even before the creation of the earth, it has never been lost. Why do you say that you are looking for it again? From long ago until now, it has been unimpeded and has been shining brightly and tranquilly. Assembly gathered here today, have you completely awakened to it or not? If there is a monk endowed with the Dharma eye, let him say something. In reality, what is this subtle wisdom of complete enlightenment? Let me introduce you to a few words from a lecture of Master Dzogchen. He once said, all sentient beings are covered by the six dusts. This would mean the dusts are the thoughts associated with the six senses, the five ordinary senses and thinking. So thoughts and all the other things we get attached to. This means that they are covered by the six kinds of thieves that come from the outside. Now, this idea of the thieves, the six thieves, is a common one that we run across in Buddhist texts. And he elaborates on it. And for people who don't know what the idea is, I'll read from it. He says, if you feel that you are not yet a Buddha, this means that the downfall of the six thieves is still to take place. All things in the external world that pass through the six sense doors are like thieves who are intent on cheating you. They continuously deceive you and drag you here and there. And as soon as you are deceived in even the slightest way by one of these thieves, it is equivalent to being killed by them. For at that moment they take control of your mind. So we can see this again and just take this, the sense of sight. Every time we allow ourselves to glance around during sesshin, we run the risk of having our attention hijacked and getting off into a train of thought that just leads on and on. Take this to heart. When moving around during break periods, at meals, work, maintain this discipline, keeping the eyes down. When even just coming into Zendo, keep the eyes down. Otherwise, you're asking for distractions. In the face of these six thieves, as soon as the slightest thought appears in the doorway of one of the six senses, you should be as alarmed as though a thief were trying to break into your house. The moment one of the six thieves shows itself in the doorway of the senses, the koan investigation of the essential will have deserted you. Otherwise, how could one of the thieves have appeared in the first place? For as long as the koan is held firmly in mind, the six sense doors will be kept tightly closed, and there will be no gap through which a thief could enter. Therefore, the koan remains vivid. You remain alive. But as soon as one of the six thieves manages to enter the door of the senses, you are already dead. Well, I suppose someone could say, well, this is such a natural environment, sesshin. Where can we find this kind of seclusion and cutting off of the senses anywhere else? Well, true. This is an extraordinary environment. But it's what makes it much more possible to have an initial awakening to our true nature is by maintaining these restrictions. In order to cause the downfall of the six thieves, you must cast aside all concern for the body. You should discard it as you would a useless stone that serves no purpose. Habitually, you blindly follow your uncontrolled attachment to the body and thus spend your entire lives trying to feed it and clothe it well, thereby making sure that it is comfortable. Throughout beginningless eons, you have been the servant of the body and have thus played the role of an ordinary sentient being. From now on, you should learn to make it serve you. We could relate this to the colds and sickness that have been going around circulating in this sesshin this week. And one could, if one were attached to these things, start to fret, even catastrophize about it. But really, looking at the big picture, okay, you get a cold, even you get sick. How does that compare to our imminent, our inevitable death? How will we be able to manage our mind when we're dying, if we're afraid of a cold? We take the precautions we can to avoid it, of course. But the center of our focus, our priority should be the mind, seeing into the nature of the mind and coming to awakening. Says, and finally, instead of being captivated by the six senses, you should also make them obey you. Henceforth, it is you who must have the final word. In this way, your practice will be able to progress well. It is a great mistake to think that after having practiced hard for a few days, you are then entitled to lie back and enjoy yourself for a while. It is easy to find any number of pretexts for behaving in this manner, but to do so will cause you to be killed by the six thieves. Thus, you will be reduced to playing the role of a corpse. This danger of sitting back and enjoying ourselves after hard several days of sesshin practice. I mentioned this yesterday, I think, the danger of coasting, getting into a space of relative ease. We're not fighting the pain the way we were earlier, let's say. One of the Chinese masters, Po Shan, warns in this way: once those who have lived amidst the noise and restlessness of worldly affairs experience the joy of quietness, they become captivated by its honey-sweet taste, craving it like an exhausted traveler who seeks a peaceful den in which to slumber. How can people with such an attitude retain their awareness? Again, always a question of what is it you want? Do you want to just relish the calm of a mind that has become quieted through the work we've done so far? Or do you want more than that? Do you want to see, awaken to your own true nature? We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind patterns. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attend.